All right. So, first of all, today's, as I said, today's class is going to be a little bit abbreviated, but that's actually, it fits also with what we're doing because we're just doing the end of chapter 19, and today's class is very much X-rated. In ways you both have seen and in ways you're about to discover. So, first of all, let's turn to chapter 19, to the end of the chapter. We are on verse, 29. Actually, we had looked at 28, the smoke of a kiln. That's Abraham looking at it, and it says, thus it was that when God destroyed the cities of the plain and annihilated the cities where Lot dwelt, God was mindful of Abraham and removed Lot from the midst of the upheaval. All right. Now we're on 30. We're going to start really with 30. That's just the setup, which is God took Lot out of it and Lot's family. Lot, of course, is an ambiguous character so far, but he's about to get more ambiguous, maybe, depending on how you look at it. Lot, yes. Not that I'm aware of, no. I'm sure it has some origin. I can look it up in the name book, but not that I'm aware of. Lot went up from Zoar and settled in the hill country with his two daughters, for he was afraid to dwell in Zoar, and he and his daughters lived in a cave. All right, so there is this great primitiveness about Lot's, about the way Lot comes out of a succession of catastrophes. And the older one said to the younger, okay, Avinu Zaken, our father is old. Does that ring any bells for you?
Abraham.
Right. Remember, this is what Sarah said about Abraham. How are we going to have a kid? Abraham is so old, right? By the way, thank you for that notice. And there is not a man on earth to consort with us in the way of all the world. Now, they could have meant this figuratively or literally. Just the way you say, you know, I can't find anyone. Or there's nobody in the world who. Or they may in fact have thought quite literally that there was nobody in the world. Because everything had been destroyed. It's not clear. So she says, come, let us make our father drink wine. And let us lie with him that we may maintain life through our father. Now, I mean, obviously, you can read this to her credit or to her discredit. What she's saying is, without this act of incest, our line will disappear, and maybe she even thinks humanity will disappear. So, that night, they made their father drink wine, and the older one went in and lay with her father. He did not know when she lay down or when she rose. Now, does this mean that he didn't know what happened? Okay. What's that?
The only way this can happen is to get him drunk.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a certain loss of memory or
right.
Consciousness. But
so he is presumably blameless in this.
Well,
why? Of course, when you're under anesthesia, you can't have intercourse. Presumably. Right? Not as a man. Right? Yeah.
I think alcohol is usually a shame zapper. It's what a cocktail hour
right.
Was really developed to take people's shame away so they can socialize.
It takes their shame away, but it doesn't take their sentience completely away. I mean, not completely. I mean, you have all these movies where two people wake up and they say, you know, did we sleep together last night?
Yes.
But, yes, I don't know if that happens in real life.
I think this is the way of writing the Torah in such a way as to make God blameless. This is obviously a sin, and they didn't, you know, they didn't want it to seem that way. I mean, they didn't think it would be
okay. So this presumes that something actually happened, and they're writing about it a certain way to exonerate him. as opposed to the idea that they're telling a story to a certain purpose. You could see it either way. You could see it either way. Because the reason I bring all this up, other than the fact that how can you not, is that the next day, the older one said to the younger, "See, I lay with father last night. Let us make him drink wine tonight also, and you go and lie with him, that we may maintain life through our father." The question is, if he's innocent the first time, is he innocent the second time? What the rabbis say is, okay, maybe he was innocent the first time, but he got drunk again. And they find it hard to believe he had no idea that anything went on that night. Yeah.
Wine, so I can do this. Mm. Like, there's somehow they're in on it.
So here he's trying to fortify his courage, so to speak.
Like, I don't know. I kind of have. And anyway, they're from Sodom,
right,
where all kinds of weird things are happening all the time and without too much help.
Right.
To happen. So.
Yeah.
Well, it says that he didn't know when she lay down and when she rose. It doesn't say he didn't know what happened.
What happened in between. Yes, that's true. And again, the Bible could easily have said he had no idea what happened. And it repeats the exact same formula with the second one. That night they made their father drink wine. He didn't know when she lay down, when she rose.
He didn't know which daughter it was or who it was because he didn't see the person coming or going. But when he was in the act, no one else really knew who it was.
Yeah, if he slept with somebody, I would guess that he would know. But notice, if you look, by the way, in the Hebrew text, there is it's verse 33. The last word in verse 33, uvakuma. Do you see that? Do you notice there's a little dot over the vav? Do you see that mark over the vav? That mark doesn't belong there. So, according to Rashi, what this means is he kind of knew when she got up, right? He didn't know when she lay down, but he kind of knew when she got up, and yet he did it again. That's Rashi's interpretation. Now, I mean, it doesn't say that in the text, but he's trying to interpret why the dot is there, yeah.
He justified just as well as his daughter.
I didn't say he couldn't. Yeah. I'm just trying to figure out whether he knew what he was doing.
But I'm saying if he did know what he was doing, he's saying better that the world should continue.
Except that I don't think, I mean, it doesn't seem to me that Lot would be that naive as to think the whole world was destroyed, because you could understand a kid thinking that,
but
I don't think he thought that. Yeah.
When Rashi read this, you said that Rashi made a comment. Rashi didn't read it with that thought on it.
Oh, no, sure he did. By Rashi's time, he did. The diacritical marks were all made by the Masoretes.
Okay.
So So he had a manuscript that had the dots. The rabbis, sometimes they make comments on things like that, sometimes not. Some of the dots they apparently had too. We don't know where some of them originated. Some of them are way back in, yeah.
It seems to me that when you drink, I mean, having worked with a lot of alcoholics, that when somebody is drinking, you get into a Dionysian kind of state of mind, in which all sorts of things go on.
Do you remember them later?
Very often, no. That's what a blackout is.
Right, a blackout. Yep.
Blackout, you remember.
The lost weekend, right.
And while it's happening, your social judgment is really not present. So
right.
Even if you can move and parts of you can function, that you actually don't make judgments. That's why for a long time in our culture, we didn't have people against drunk drivers. I mean, they couldn't help it. And still, a whole social movement came so that you... saying that you're responsible to not get drunk because that's what a Dionysian state is like.
Right. And do you remember, by the way, speaking of this, what the first thing is that Noah does after the flood?
He gets drunk.
Noah, the tiller of the soil, was the first to plant a vineyard. He drank of the wine and became drunk and uncovered himself within his tent. So it isn't just that he drinks. It's that he drinks and his drinking leads to sexual mishaps, remember, with his kids, whatever they are. We don't say exactly what they are. So it's clear that there's a pattern here. Great catastrophe leads to obliteration and to sexual shenanigans. Yeah.
I have a question. It's very ironic that God destroyed, for example, destroyed the whole humanity to make a villa. And Noah did that, and then he destroyed the whole city of Sodom, and then after this is what destroying the humanity to make them better?
That's a great question. It's a great question because, I mean, what you're saying is that often when God punishes, it's counterproductive. He punishes and then people go ahead and do miserable things. It's true, although you could also say, that the lesson isn't supposed to necessarily be immediate. I mean, it takes long term for the lesson to sink in. So you would have to know how Lot's daughters, and we'll come back to this, how that story has been read and understood through the generations, and that's actually going to be shortly the theme of today's class.
So these are also the daughters that he offered up to the townspeople of
the Sodom. Yes. He already debased them sexually, maybe even in their own eyes.
Right.
Yes. Right. Yeah.
It could even be that this was happening already before this.
It's possible that they could already, even though he said they're virgins, it's possible that they weren't. Yeah, it certainly is.
One thing, he didn't know the first time, the second time, is it a sin that he was doing?
Well, according to, yes. According to Rashi, absolutely. Yeah. But he says young daughters when he's, I mean, they're relatively young. I'm assuming 13, 14, because that's usually when girls got married in biblical times, right?
Yes. I do want to point out there's something very interesting here that, that you mentioned in another class with Hagar. I mean, today people trying to get pregnant and they say, oh, I've been trying for
right.
6 months. It's a little bit different paradigm
yes.
here.
That's exactly right. It wasn't that they had a greater understanding of fertility. I think it was that they were explicitly commenting on the difference, which is again happens again and again, between the conception of the righteous, which is difficult and fraught throughout the Bible, and this. I mean, the same thing happens to Abraham later. Abraham has a whole bunch of kids with Keturah, doesn't seem to have any problems.
Right.
But with Sarah, it's anguish, which is, and it is often true in heroic stories that the birth of a hero is not easy. There's some obstacle. And I want to come to the last section and then talk about the theme of Lot's daughters. Thus, the two daughters of Lot came to be with child by their father. The older one bore a son and named him Moav. He is the father of the Moabites of today. Now, Moav, what word does that have in it?
Av.
Av meaning?
Father.
So the rabbis condemn her for naming the kid Moav because it's like, you know, it's like naming your kid incest. And the younger also bore a son, and she called him Ben-Ami, which means son of my people, which is a much more respectable name. He's the father of the Ammonites of today. Now, one of the there's a lot of discussion. Moab and Ammon were both enemies of Israel. So one of the speculations is that this was a way of saying, you know, you were born of incest. It's a way of sort of thumbing your nose at your enemies. You know, you create bad. It's I mean, look, to say of someone you're a son of a bitch is a way of saying your origin is discreditable. Right? And that's what they're saying here about Ammon and Moab. The scholars who argue against that say that Israel had much worse enemies than Ammon and Moab. They were not by any means the worst. And they don't invent bad origins for them. So why should they do that for Ammon and Moab, who were, you know, they had border skirmishes and so on, but they were not, in fact, the worst of the people that Israel encountered. And in fact, the other remarkable, and that's why, you know, we always, in the rest of the Bible, actually, it's always Ammon and Moab. It's never Moab and Ammon. And you ask, why should you put the younger before the older? Why Ammon and Moab? The rabbi's answer is because the younger daughter honored her father by not naming the kid incest, whereas the older one didn't. The other answer, by the way, is almost the opposite. The other answer I read is from Tosefet Bracha. He says that the reason you say Ammon and Moab is that the younger daughter was really the sin. Right? The older daughter, Moab, the first one, wasn't such a sin. Lot didn't know what he was doing. The second one was a sin by now. By the second time this happens, Lot should have known that he was getting drunk for a reason. So you always recall your greater sin first. Right? People try to always, leave that for the end. But in fact, if you're going to be righteous about it, you always have to remember the real thing that you did wrong. That's the first thing you should bring up. So two opposite reasons why they say Ammon and Moab. Anyway, having said that, what is interesting about this, of course, is that Moab is the people from which Ruth comes, right? She is a Moabite. And she's the one who eventually, through another incident in the Bible that we'll come to later of Tamar and Judah, she's the one who eventually gives birth to David. Right. So this is the beginning of the Messianic line. The Messiah comes through incest and adultery. Judah has sex with his daughter-in-law, although her husband has died, but he's not married to her, and he doesn't actually know. He thinks that it's a prostitute, even though it's in fact his daughter-in-law dressing up as a prostitute. We'll come to that later on. And here, incest. And these two very illicit unions bring the Messiah about, which is an instance of the Hebrew saying, mitzvah haba'ah ba'averah, a mitzvah that comes through a sin. And that concept, mitzvah haba'ah ba'averah, a mitzvah that comes through a sin, it has a very interesting history in Judaism, which would take a long time to go into, but it was used a lot by the Sabbateans, by the followers of Shabtai Tzvi, who would do things that were against rabbinic law, and claimed that they were trying to create a mitzvah thereby. So, but also, that in fact is the reality of the world, that sometimes bad acts have good results. And although we don't like to preach that way, we don't say that to kids. In fact, mitzvah ba'ba ve'ra is true. And here, it's a clear example of it. The incest and adultery together create the Messianic line. Now, we could talk more about that, but I want to get today, since, as I said, we have limited time today, since we're ending early, I want to get to a book that Vivian was kind enough to give me on this subject, which is a very interesting book. It's called Lot's Daughters, and already the cover tells you something of what it's about, because it's a pair of legs in fishnet stockings, as you can see. So why did she give me this book? Because what it is an examination by Robert Polhemus, who is an English professor. I think he teaches at Berkeley. Where does he teach? Stanford, somewhere up there. So it is an investigation of the theme of older man, younger woman, and sometimes the eroticization of father-daughter throughout Western literature and history and the way in which Lot's Daughters is used. And he wrote this shortly after the Lewinsky scandal, and brings that into it. I quickly skimmed the book, and I only actually read the first part, and the first part is the part that I want to talk about, but he traces it through literature, through movies, everything from Finnegan's Wake, James Joyce's last book, which begins by talking actually in part about Lot's daughters. Dad's Lottiest Daughter Pearl is the way Joyce always plays with the English language, never says anything straight out. And talks about why this is such a powerful theme. What is it that older men want from younger women? What is it that younger women want from older men? And how does that, what are the permutations here? And Lot's Daughters is, so he lists several, I don't know if I'll read them all, there are about 10 or 11 different things that he thinks are going on that he then teases out through the rest of the book. And since this is, you can see, a very, very powerful theme. I mean, just look at pop stars. Girl pop stars, they're all incredibly young. Does that mean that only young people watch them? Probably not. This is, once, yeah. Yes. Right, there is a tradition in some places of that, but not. Right. The lord of the manor. I haven't heard of fathers doing it, though.
Nobleman,
right.
Of the estate.
Yeah, But I haven't heard of fathers doing it. But he does, right. But he does have wonderful pictures as well of Lot's daughters portrayed in very different ways. But in most of them, Lot actually looks fairly righteous, interestingly enough. The author is Polhemus, P-O-L-H-E-M-U-S. It is still available on Amazon because I looked. It's called Lot's Daughters. And let me read you features of the Lot complex in modern life, okay? Just in case you think that the Bible is no longer relevant. But listen to this, very interesting, I thought. Sex for pleasure versus sex to preserve seed. The tension between the desire to use sex for immediate gratification and to use it for the regeneration of life and the sake of the future, right? I mean, when we talk, for example, as I just did the other day, to kids about sexuality, and sexuality before marriage and sexuality in marriage, right? There is this constant, what is the purpose of sexuality? Is it so human beings can feel pleasure? Is it so that they can create new life? Progeny, preservation of seed, the primary responsibility of humanity. The primacy of the father-daughter relationship. Lot provides a corrective, that means an answer, to the Oedipus complex, skewed stress on the primacy of son and mother roles, right? The Oedipus complex is all about how sons are in love with their mothers, but what about daughters and fathers? There clearly is a relationship between daughters and fathers, and it also becomes not problematic, but it becomes complicated for the daughter, for the father, and for the mother when the daughter becomes sexual, when the daughter hits puberty. It changes the dynamic of the relationship, right? So this is also something, I mean, Lot already saw his daughters as sexual because he says to the men, you can have them, as you pointed out earlier, and then all of a sudden he's the one who ends up having them. The existence and force of incestuous impulses, both conscious and unconscious, right? Incest does exist, right? It is a reality in the world. There must be an impulse, even if very weak or hidden. But in the Bible, it's clear that this is something that's not completely absent from the reality. And that's one of the reasons why there's a very, very, very strong taboo against incest in the Bible. Why does it say many times you absolutely must not do this? It would only say that if there was some impulse to do it. Otherwise, you don't tell people don't do this, right? Things that people don't want to do, you don't have to tell them not to do. But there must be something here that is involved and that the Bible knows is destructive to the human, which it clearly is, to the human family, to relationships, I mean, obviously. This I thought was interesting. This I made a little mark by to be sure to read it. The power of projection. I'm just going to read this because it has a very powerful place in religion in general. People think about, wish for, and sometimes ruthlessly do forbidden things, but they don't like to feel guilty. And so they often project their wishes and responsibilities onto others. It's not me, but God who wants the destruction of my vicious foes and my stony, bitter old spouse. It's not me, but these naughty, crazy girls who get me drinking and coax me into bed. It's not me, but the good of society and my victimization that makes me seduce and use an older man for my purposes, right? It's always that idea of projection, and clearly this was what you were saying about Lot. Maybe Lot was involved in this, maybe he wasn't. But if you asked Lot, what would he say? They got me drunk, it wasn't my fault, they did it, I woke up, I had no idea what happened. None at all. Not the first time, not the second time. The drive for female agency, the development of female subjectivity in order to establish and sustain civil culture. In other words, how do women become actors as opposed to acted upon? Especially young women in our culture, where they don't have as much of a public voice as men, and they discover that what power do they have? Sexual power. And so by saying your sexual power is illegitimate to use, you're also saying the power that you have is illegitimate to use. Because nobody says, I mean, we're just now saying to some extent to boys, the aggression that you have is illegitimate to use, but we still have lots and lots and lots of legitimate outlets for boys' aggression. There aren't lots and lots and lots of legitimate outlets for girls' sexual power, right? Let's see. In the Lot myth, this is a subversive evolutionary pattern. In the Lot myth, the objects of desire, the objects that power seems to be able to dispose of at will themselves become empowered. In other words, Lot was going to get rid of his daughters. He had power over them, but in the end, they got power over him. They turned it around. Our father was going to dispose of us. We'll use him. Which is something that actually would not normally have occurred to me, but the truth is that in the end, the women, who in the Bible, by the way, does not blame. The Bible doesn't say they were bad, they'll be punished, nothing of that. There is no, which is weird for the Bible not to condemn incest. You know, the Bible has a very hard line against incest. It doesn't condemn them, first of all, because it seems that they think there's no other men in the world, so it's a situation of extremes. The rabbis even say that. It's called a shahat hadchak, a moment of extreme emergency, and at such times, they say that the Torah can be canceled, right? In other words, there are times when you have to do things that the Torah would forbid in order to save the world. Yeah. Yes, absolutely. It does add to their power. They could have discussed it with him, but they wanted to take it in their own hands and be also part of eternal being, the drive for permanence, which clearly, I mean, is part of this, the drive for reproduction. The Lot scripture says that the law of fathers must sometimes be broken to preserve the law of the fathers. It says the life force may depend on drunkenness and blind sexual arousal, and drink and sex corrupt family life and family values. It says both. This passage is relevant. This is the seed from which we spring. And also, these are not our people. Be glad and learn from their example. Which is true. I mean, because it's Ammon and Moab. It does not say this is the origin of the Jewish people. Right? Abraham and Sarah are very respectable. And when there is a problem with Hagar and so on, it's dealt with at great length and great angst. And you ask questions and all of that. But at the same time, as we know, this is going to be the messianic line. So it is a very, one of the things he also talks about, I'll finish it because I'm almost done. Most important, crucial in modern history, the complex Lot pattern can figure as a human success story in which fathers and daughters, older men and younger women, develop for the benefit of society and cultural progress, or as the preservation and misuse of obscenely despotic power, erotic viciousness, incestuous bad faith, irresponsible oppression. It can be both, right? Older men, younger women can be, in some ways, helpful, progressive, mentoring good, can be destructive. I mean, and that he wrote this after the Lewinsky scandal is a perfect illustration of both what was expected of that relationship and what resulted of that relationship. And also, do you remember the arguments afterwards about who was the responsible agency? Whether it was her, whether it was him, and people made arguments on both sides. And I don't want to revisit the arguments, but the point is that there were people who said, you know, well, look, he's a man, and we all know that men are subject to this, and she knew exactly what she was doing. And then there were people who said, on the other hand, he's the president of the United States, right? He's got a lot of power. And the point was that each side that felt the helplessness of the situation from their side attributed the power to the other side. Do you know what I'm saying? Okay, if not, then I don't know how, then discuss amongst yourselves. Okay. Split personality, schizoid being, pluralistic identity as characteristic of female representations. In other words, he says, the daughter made binary is a striking fact. There are two of them, not one. Why are there two of them? Because they represent a dual nature. They're daughters, helpless, socially unempowered, to be done with as they will. They're full of power, seductresses. They get him drunk. They do what they want. Mother, mate, sister, daughter. The female role in Lot is one who must live and act in concert with another. All those roles. Okay. And then they talk about Lot as an anti-hero. I mean, Lot's a hero, but he's an idiot, right? Again and again, we see Lot is saved, but Lot is worthless. I mean, if Lot were the Jewish ancestor, we'd want to tear those pages out of the Bible. Thank God it's Abraham and not Lot. And then finally, and this is also that human life is defined not only by the crises of history. We say the Jewish people came out of the Holocaust, the destruction of the temple, the Spanish Inquisition, but also by personal trauma. Personal trauma. The traumas of your life are part of what define you. There was somebody that I hadn't seen for, I hadn't spoken to. I last seen him at his wedding in Israel. And he said to me, so what's been going on the past 4 or 5 years? I said, well, I had brain surgery. I could have said, you know, I moved to a new apartment. But for some reason, and by the way, it got a great reaction too, you know. Which is, he said, you what? So part of the way we define ourselves is by personal trauma. And that was clearly, I think that it's fair to say that had Sodom not been destroyed, Lot would never have slept with his daughters. And that part of what the Bible is saying is that this kind of, that there is a certain suspension of judgment that you have to make at such, I mean, here's a man who saw his entire world literally, literally destroyed. Not just, you know, his village was razed, but his entire world was destroyed. And there's a lot of the ambiguity of who's in power, why they did this, the fact that the Messiah comes out of something makes it a very, it's such a short episode, but there is a great deal in it. Yeah.
I think it was Ernest Hemingway, I'm not sure, who said those who are not broken are killed.
Oh, I always heard that which doesn't break me makes me stronger, is Nietzsche said that. And Hemingway also did say, we're all broken, but many of us are stronger in the broken places, which is a way of making your, right. Yeah, if you don't get broken,
yes,
then you don't live. So that I think that that's also clearly an idea in the Bible. You know, it's there's actually the idea that the only whole heart is a broken one, right? The Kotzker Rebbe, there's a nice passage about that also, that Rabbi Alexandri, in line with what Hemingway says in the Talmud. He says, quoting the verse from Psalms, which actually was what I used for the title of my first book, that God is Harofe L'Shvurei Lev, the healer of shattered hearts. That's what I titled my first book, Healer of Shattered Hearts, because I thought it was such a beautiful image for God. And he says, when human beings use broken vessels, they're embarrassed, right? You bring out chipped plates or broken dishes. He said, but God only wants broken vessels, which is a beautiful idea, right? That you can't go through life unbroken, and if you do, God wants nothing to do with you because, yeah.
I'm struggling because I'm currently reading Sholem Usher's The Nazarene.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I never read it. You have to tell us how it is.
No.
You have to do a book report when you're done.
Pages.
Well, when you're done. Just say good, bad, thumbs up, thumbs down.
Right.
That's all. Okay. All right. Good.
The Jesus of the book is clearly an outsider. And the Torah sets us up for things that come later.
Yes.
Whether this is incest or not, or whether he was impotent or not,
right,
impotent because of alcohol, I think we can dance on.
Well, he wasn't impotent because they both get pregnant. Right.
We're talking about two different things. But being a line of from adultery and incest,
yes,
which are very powerful factors, is setting us up because the house of David comes from that line.
Right.
And we can't ignore that there is some kind of a feeling that that just as Ishmael's line is outside of us,
right,
the house of David may be born outside of us, and the Messiah may not be of us. You can't ignore, when you said that Ruth is the beginning of the Davidic line coming out of a family of incest,
right,
and adultery, that's too powerful for me to not say there's some tale for us to beware and wary of the outsider.
Well, I don't.
Clearly, the Jesus I'm reading about was...
Well, forget... Well, let's first of all, let's remove for a moment Jesus from this whole question, because that's a question in and of itself. And remember that the writers of the New Testament very consciously modeled their picture of Jesus on the Hebrew Bible, because they all knew it, and that's what they, you know, I mean, Jesus riding in a donkey into Jerusalem, this is based on their knowledge that that's what's predicted in Zechariah. So it's not surprising that it... you know, if you now wanted to make an ideal American, you'd have lots of writings to base it on. Then if someone came along and said, isn't it amazing how the person in this writing fulfills all the ideals of America, you'd say, you know, they got it backwards. But the idea that the Messiah is an outsider because he's born of incest and adultery, I would say, is a theme that actually touches virtually every leader. Almost all the great leaders of history, in one way or another, are seen as outsiders. And when they're insiders, they position themselves as outsiders, right? That's, I mean, just like political candidates do today. People who were born and raised, who never stepped out of the Beltway in their lives, are coming to Washington to reform Washington because this town needs some new. I mean, that's because that's how we respond to leaders. Why does the Lincoln log cabin mythos have such great? I mean, here's a guy who went to law school. He wasn't a country bumpkin. He wasn't an idiot. He was a very, very smart and savvy man long before he ever got to Washington. But the idea that he's an outsider has great appeal to us. So I think that it is true that the Bible is setting us up. I mean, Moses, who's born in the, is sort of a double outsider and an insider. He's born in the palace, but he really isn't of the palace, and he runs away to Midian, and he comes back. So I agree with you. The outsider theme is very, isn't that the name? That's the name of Colin Wilson's book, I think, The Outsider. Yeah. That famous classic of existentialism from somebody who then went on to write 60 other books that nobody read. Yeah. He wrote this poor guy, this English author. He wrote this when he was like 20 or 21 or 22, called The Outsider. It's a brilliant book. It synthesizes all sorts of stuff. And he never wrote he wrote lots and lots more books, mostly, by the way, about paranormal stuff. But after that book, nobody ever really read. Colin Wilson. It's called The Outsider. And it's quite a remarkable book. It really is. I have one other book by him about the books in his life, books that he read. But anyway, yeah.
Going back to Lot's daughters, that one thing that I sort of noticed is that Lot's wife turns into a pillar of salt, but there's no discussion of how they all react to that.
So that's true.
They have lost their mother, he's right. Lost their wife, and maybe that sort of somehow plays in.
She must have come up over the dinner table, presumably. sorry. Yes. I do think, by the way, yes, that is absolutely true. Clearly, I mean, who is it who says this in the Talmud? I think it's Rabbi Yochanan, but I'm not sure. I think I'm wrong. He says the eye has a light part and a dark part, and you can only see through the dark part, which is a very beautiful. To return to the mother thing, also, the other thing that makes the incest possible is that mother is gone. I mean, that's the only thing that enables the daughters, obviously. In this case, if the mother was right there in the cave, the daughters would not be able to do that. Yeah. Which also, by the way, I just want to say, from a modern point of view, when incest occurs between a father and a daughter, it says something either literal or metaphorical about the absence of the mother.
Right?
Right? Yeah. Right. That's also true. It could very well be that people in Sodom did this. Right.
So maybe it wasn't as bad at that time.
Right. It may not have been thought of as abnormal. I mean, in Israel it would have, but in Sodom it was thought of as this is what people do. Let me wrap up. Go ahead.
It seems to me that when you're talking about not of our family, it clearly is of our family, because he just said that the reason God saved him was because he was Abraham. It was
right.
For Abraham.
Oh, I didn't. Right.
And so we're talking about both inside of family and outside of the family throughout that, with Ishmael being in the family.
They're the bad cousins.
Exactly.
Is what they are, right.
Which is really, I think, very important.
Yep.
Rather than
that's true.
Them.
They're the ones we don't visit.
Yes, on. Didn't yep. Torah
exactly. They're the ones who are always writing and asking for money, and, you know, they're the bad cousins. I want to close, though, by saying something. There is actually, though, also something very beautiful about the story, which is that, you know, it's almost analogous to this. You know, first we had the entire city destroyed and all salt I mean, it's all destruction. There's nothing left. And the first thing that happens after that story is the creation of life. There is a resilience in the human spirit, even in people who are not, you know, the best of the best. There's a resilience in the humans that doesn't want to give up. They saw destruction, and what is their first impulse? To have children, in the same way that we all know that after wars, the birth rate goes up. And that is a good thing, and that's a promising thing, and a hopeful thing, and that may be in part why this is part of the lineage of the Messiah, because the thing that the Messiah represents more than anything else is hope, is indestructible hope, that every single time there's tragedy, there's difficulty, there's so on, the Jewish people talk about the Messiah, right? You know, afal pi sheyit mamea, even though the Messiah delays, im kol zeh ani ma'amin, with all of that, I still believe. And even though it starts in very dirty soil, that's, you know, the soil out of which plants grow. So I'm sorry that we have to end early, and I got to go run interview, but thank you very much.